It all even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 1st of August. I'm Marco.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's currently 5:10 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are segment one. Our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion, which is me, of this week's top science findings.
Cool. We also have an interview with UBC Poli-Sci Professor Arjun Chaudhary. He specializes in international relations and security studies. News 101 correspondent Rohit Joseph spoke to him about the historical context of the Israel-Palestine conflict, Egypt's relationship with Palestine, and the long-term goals and strategies that Hamas and the IDF may have in mind.
But first, some headlines for today.
In campus news, outgoing President Stephen Toop's travel bill has been released. Yesterday, UBC released the outgoing president's travel expenses. Stephen Toop officially chalked up nearly $170,000 in the past year alone, vastly outstripping colleagues at both McGill and the University of Toronto. A UBC spokesperson said the substantial expenses reflect an exhaustive year of fundraising, outreaching, and lobbying. UBC's Vice President of Communications added that Mr. Toop was the quote-unquote senior spokesperson for Canada's largest research university with the federal government, with new presidents at both U of T and McGill. Most of the outgoing president's airfare was business class, which the university sees as cost-effective since it allows Mr. Toop to work in flight and arrive rested. UBC's Vice President of Communications said, quote, "Making a significant donation to the university is a very personal decision. Sometimes it takes the president face-to-face to close the deal." According to UBC financial documents, Mr. Toop's international trips helped collect $33 million from alumni and donors. Compared to Mr. Toop's $168,000, U of T's president David Naylor reported $61,000 in the same year, and McGill's Suzanne Fortier used only $21,000.
In local news, Vancouver Pride events are underway. Vancouver's annual Pride celebration events kicked off this week, starting with a Pride proclamation and launch at Vancouver City Hall on Monday. Events were ongoing all week and will culminate in the family-friendly Sunset Beach Festival and Market on Sunday, August 3rd, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., which is expected to draw more than 150,000 people, and with the Pride Parade in downtown Vancouver. The parade runs from 12 to 3 on the 3rd of August, which is Sunday, and features 130 floats. The parade is expected to be viewed by upwards of 650,000 spectators. Vancouver's Pride celebration is the largest in Western Canada, and events are described by Pride Vancouver as being, quote, accessible and inclusive of every ethnicity, demographic, and regardless of mobility, end quote. For more information on the rest of this week's weekend's events, please visit the Vancouver Pride website at www.vancouverpride.ca.
In provincial news, the British Columbia School Trustees Association sent out a press release this past Thursday, July 31st, launching a back-to-school action plan, as they call it. The press release states that, quote, BC's school trustees know that a balance must be found between the bargaining objectives of the BC Teachers Federation and the economic mandate established by the provincial government, end quote. The back-to-school action plan calls for several key changes to current bargaining. Firstly, for the BC Teachers Federation to, quote, modify the benefit increases teachers are seeking so that the overall compensation package will fall within the range accepted by other public sector unions, end quote. The action plan would also see the provincial government put all of the money saved during the strike and lockout into the Learning Improvement Fund, which goes towards supporting students, student learning, class composition, and class size. Finally, the action plan would require the BCTF, the provincial government, and all other education partners to sit down to talks to establish new labor and bargaining relations structures. The press release ends with the BCSTA stating that they are, quote, committed to have our schools open on September 2nd, end quote.
In other BC news, U.S. energy firm Apache Corp leaves the Our corporation leaves the Kitimat LNG project. Houston-based Apache, which had been developing the project with Chevron, announced that it will be withdrawing from any involvement in its second quarter financial report yesterday. The report stated that, quote, consistent with the company's ongoing repositioning for profitable and repeatable North American onshore growth, Apache intends to completely exit the Wheatstone and Kitimat LNG projects, end quote. Apache is also planning on divesting in its interest in a major liquid natural gas project in Australia. According to the Canadian press, the corporation has been under pressure for some time from New York hedge fund Jana Partners LLC, an activist investor to sell its assets in LNG products. Apache announced its partnership with Chevron in December of 2012. It's expected that the departure of Apache will be a serious drawback for the project, which has been granted the only environmental assessment certificate by the provincial government to date. In an interview with the Vancouver Observer, Premier Christy Clark's office said, quote, while today's news that Apache intends to leave the Kitimat LNG project changes the ownership structure of that particular proposal, we remain committed to developing a competitive liquefied natural gas export industry in British Columbia, end quote. Chevron has not commented on whether or not the project will go through without the financial backing of Apache. Many analysts are skeptical the project will be completed. However, the mayor of Kitimat, Joanne Monahan, is confident that if this project falls through, other LNG projects will be developed in the area. Previous to this announcement, Apache had stated that it was cutting its spending for Kitimat LNG by 40%, from $1 billion to $600 million.
And in international news, international investigators arrived at the MH17 crash site amidst ongoing rebellion. This morning, the main body of the international investigative team sent to examine the wreckage of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 arrived on site after days of being blocked by clashes taking place along their route. A smaller, quote, advance team arrived yesterday to survey the crash site and establish a base of operations at a nearby farm. According to the Associated Press, the team's top priority is to recover human remains that have been decomposing since the plane went down 2 weeks ago. The team will be combing the rural area for jet debris and the bodies of the 80 victims that are yet to be recovered. As of their arrival yesterday, the site has officially been declared a crime scene and will be divided into grids to enable a systematic search. Independent observers warned that evidence may have been tampered with in the 2 weeks since the crash took place. Both the Ukrainian and rebel forces agreed to a tentative ceasefire around the crash zone, but only hours before the investigative team arrived this morning, rebels ambushed a Ukrainian convoy outside the nearby town of Shakhtarsk. 10 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in the ambush, with 13 more soldiers unaccounted for, and 4 bodies that are as of yet unidentified. Ukraine security spokesman Vladislav Seleznev said the attack took place at 6 a.m. this morning, before the end of the 24-hour, quote, day of quiet declared Thursday, adding that, quote, the militants are behaving in a cowardly and shameless fashion, using the day of quiet just to fire on us, end quote.
In more international news, the World Health Organization, WHO, or WHO, warns that West Africa's Ebola outbreak could soon be out of control. WHO Chief Margaret Chan spoke with the presidents of Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and the Ivory Coast today, warning them that, quote, the outbreak is moving faster than our efforts to control it, and adding that, quote, this meeting must mark a turning point in the outbreak response. According to WHO officials, it is in urgent talks with donors and international agencies to send more medical staff and resources to the affected region. The WHO has already pledged to launch a $100 million response plan in the coming days. Between Sierra Leone, Liberia, Nigeria, and Guinea, 57 new deaths were reported last week, bringing the death toll to 729. The organization says the number of Ebola cases had already topped 1,300. Sierra Leone and neighboring Liberia have already declared a state of emergency, calling in their militaries to quarantine Ebola victims and attempt to control the outbreak. In Nigeria, regional airlines continue to cancel flights to major cities after Nigeria's Civil Aviation Authority suspended the airline responsible for bringing Ebola to Lagos, Africa's most populated city with 21 million residents. Other African countries, including Ghana, where one of the Nigerian flights made a stop, have begun to introduce body temperature screening for all travelers. Finally, the Public Health Agency of Canada has upgraded its travel health notice, saying that Canadians should avoid all non-essential travel to Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
And that's local, provincial, and international headlines on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but please stay tuned.
Campus, traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
On 1.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a segment, our weekly science and technology with Marco.
In today's science and technology news, there are a few studies on outer space, a few local stories, and some more reports on the Ebola virus and what is being done to help the victims. In the first story, in BC local news, a SFU study is questioning the feasibility of fracking for extracting liquid natural gas from BC. In a SFU study, the methods of fracking, which is injecting steam and chemicals into the earth for the release of the natural gas, has issues in terms of waste, the wastewater, and how toxic this may be. The SFU study says that not a lot of knowledge of the fate of the chemicals once they go into the ground are known. The SFU study said, we do not know what the harmful chemicals do to the ground. Also, prior to, during, and after the fracking, tests have not been done on how the chemicals affect the air, the water, the land, and the surrounding environment. The U.S. has 24 regulatory bodies that coordinate and regulate rules about fracking, but BC does not do this. So the SFU study reported that BC should coordinate its regulatory agencies in a better manner. In other local news, the park board last night decided the fate of the cetaceans in the BC Aquarium. That's right, cetaceans are the beluga whales. The future of Vancouver's aquarium belugas were decided at a meeting last night. After weeks of hearing, the park board, in a unanimous vote, voted to keep keeping the cetaceans in captivity. The board heard from dozens of speakers on the controversial issue. One of the reports that was discussed was from Dr. Joseph Gados, a chief scientist from the Wildlife Health Center and Sea Doc Society program in the University of California, Davis. The doctor suggested a large-scale scientific study on the welfare of captive cetaceans. This would be the next logical step. Dr. John Nightingale of the Vancouver Aquarium commented on the decision made by the park board. Although he lauded the decision, in general, one part of the decision was questioned by Dr. Nightingale. These animals that are in captivity in the Vancouver Aquarium are rescue animals, so they were not taken out of the sea when they were healthy. The controversial decision at the meeting last night was we should keep the cetaceans in captivity, but do not let them mate. Dr. Nightingale said this is a critical error because he feels that the animals were rescued and they should be allowed to mate. In space news, the iconic Apollo 11 view of Earth turns 45 years old last week. Last week, it was 45 years since Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first people to walk on the face of the moon. Perhaps the most famous photo from this was the iconic pearl blue Earth against the deep and dark background of space. Neil Armstrong, with his famous quote, said, "One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." This is one of the most famous quotes in the history of our planet. The astronauts met this week with President Obama, but Neil Armstrong's wife was present because Neil Armstrong has since passed away. In other space news, is there going to be a new space race? Well, not to the moon, at least if the U.S. is concerned. The U.S. has its eyes on asteroids as other nations shoot for the moon. President Obama is not contemplating any ventures to the moon, and when President Obama became president, he canceled President Bush's Constellation program, which was set to go to the moon, calling it unaffordable. And quote unquote, he said, in terms of new science, there was nothing new offered by returning to the moon. Other nations like India, Iran, and Russia are thinking about going to the moon, and Japan is going to send a humanoid robot to the moon. But the U.S. is fixed on going to Mars in the next century. In other space news, a NASA satellite has captured remote Canadian fires from one of its satellites. Heavy smoke obscures the region around Yellowknife, Canada, in a new satellite image of wildfires that have choked the air and that have confined residents indoor. Indoors, Yellowknife sits on the banks of the Great Slave Lake in Canada's New West Territories, and the fire season this year in that region has been the harshest in years, with 284 fires reported so far. The fires have not threatened cities directly, but the smoke has caused road closures and air quality problems. Supply trucks and residents trying to get in and out have been told to stay in or stay away because temporary winds shifts the smoke and clogs up the highway, making it undrivable. In Ebola news, vaccines in development should be tried now, or so says a headline from the Canadian press. In 4 decades since Ebola has first been identified in Africa, the treatment options have not changed at all. Some treatments are now being developed, but none have been tested in humans. One recent treatment was tried on an American doctor and a nurse. They were injected with the antibodies from somebody that has recovered from Ebola, but doctors still do not know if this treatment will work. The outbreak has been mainly in 3 African countries, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, with 1,300 sick and more than 700 dead since March. The article from the Canadian press asks, why are there no treatments yet for the Ebola virus? It listed 3 reasons. First, Ebola is hard to work with. Ebola does not grow well in petri dishes. Second, Ebola is lethal, but it is also quite rare. And the outbreaks are very unpredictable. Although the current epidemic is the largest in history, those that have died from Ebola are much, much less than people killed by malaria or dung fever. Third, it is not economically viable for any country or any drug company to develop medicine for the Ebola virus. Fred Hayden from the University of Virginia said, quote, some of our vaccines work in animals, but have not been tested in human yet. So the doctor asked, what dose would human need to effectively fight the disease? Doctors Without Borders have claimed now that the disease is out of control, so something must be done. In Sierra Leone, they have closed schools and declared a state of emergency. In another headline, it asks how the Ebola, or it shows how the Ebola outbreak became the deadliest in history. The reasons why Ebola outbreak in West Africa have grown so large may have to do with the travel patterns of bats across Africa and recent weather patterns in the region. The outbreak of Ebola began in Guinea and affected the other countries, and experts believe that the bats have spread this. Now, these are 5 reasons why this virus is becoming or is the deadliest in history. Number one, this Ebola virus, which has 5 species, is the Zaire Ebola virus, which is the deadliest one of the 5. Before, in West Africa, the Thai forest Ebola virus was the culprit in infecting others. Number two, the affected countries are amongst the poorest in the world. They do not have the resources to combat this. That's why Canada and the U.S. are sending medical personnel to help these countries. Three, these countries lack robust healthcare systems. Number four, poverty pushes people farther into the forest. Even if Ebola had been circulating in Guinea for some time, the animals which carry the virus usually live in the jungles or the forests, not usually in the vicinity of humans. But impoverished people tend to move into such territory in search of resources. Number five, an extremely dry season may have triggered the Ebola to break out, and this could be also due to global warming. In the last story about Ebola, the Center for Disease Control in America warns against travel to Ebola-affected countries. I suppose this rates 10 out of 10 on the Duh factor. In the Duh factor, of course. One of the reasons the CDC warned against it is people could become infected with Ebola, and those who get it sick from other diseases, if they need to visit a hospital in these countries, the facilities would be deeply stressed from the outbreak. This is Marco. You are now up to date with science and technology news.
We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for our segment with Professor Arjun Chaudhary from the Political Science Department.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. Right now, it's about a balmy 23 degrees Celsius in Vancouver, mostly cloudy. Pressure is about 101.5 kilopascals. Visibility is a great 48 kilometers, so that is excellent news for all you pilots out there. Tonight, it is looking 17 degrees Celsius, so get out your shorts. It's going to be cool. Saturday is a high of 25 degrees Celsius with also a low of 17 degrees Celsius. Looks like this whole week is going to be between 25 and 24 degrees Celsius as it is on Sunday, August the 3rd. So enjoy your Pride Parade. Sunday with a low of 17 degrees. And that's about it for the weather.
Up next, we have segment two, an interview with UBC political science professor Arjun Chaudhary. He specializes in international relations and security studies. Rohit Joseph spoke to him about the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Egypt's relationship with Palestine, and the long-term goals and strategy that Hamas and the IDF may have in mind.
For CITR 101.9, and I have with me a former professor of mine who's actually quite an expert on these issues of political security. Here we have Arjun Chaudhary.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. So let's get started. What are the factors that differentiate the current Israel-Palestine conflict from prior engagements between the two sides?
Well, this is a continuation of what's been going on for some time. It's more intense, certainly, but the underlying issues are still the same. Arguably, the divide has widened, but it's not necessarily a new phase in the conflict.
There was a recent New York Times article by David Kirkpatrick. He mentions that the Egyptian government is traditionally supportive of the Palestinians. But this time, when they made a ceasefire proposal, it satisfied most of Israel's demands and none of Hamas's. Has Hamas in any way become more of an enemy to Egypt? If so, how come?
Yes, that's right. What has happened is that the current Egyptian regime, run by el-Sisi, is opposed to political Islamists. For example, they jailed their own Muslim Brotherhood people. Mm. And therefore, they are opposed to Hamas. So they have collaborated with Israel with shutting down the tunnels that go into Gaza from the Egypt side, which is the western side.
Mm-hmm.
This is a relatively new thing. Some Egyptian regime officials believe that Hamas had helped the breakout of some Muslim Brotherhood leaders in 2011 from jail. So there is an enmity between the Egyptian regime and Hamas, which means that they have been A, helping Israel crack down on the tunnels, B, not proposing ceasefire agreements that are favorable to Hamas.
Now, to what extent is this current Israel and Palestine conflict still religiously motivated, or is this still fundamentally more so a land battle? What are your thoughts on the religious aspect of this conflict?
It's fundamentally a land battle. Mm. The religious aspects pertain more to the situation with Israel's internal politics. Mm. There is an increasing Orthodox Jewish vote. They have, over time, become less supportive of a viable Palestinian state. So there is pressure on the Israeli government to take a harder line.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people argue that Israel is less secular nationalist than it used to be. So there is certainly a religious aspect which has hardened the Israeli line in recent years. However, it is fundamentally a question of land and whether the Palestinians get a state, a viable state, or not.
Now, with a recent news of the Israeli military being responsible for bombing yet another UN school in Gaza, and in general, the Israeli military inflicting a higher proportion of civilian casualties, is it fair to say that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, may be losing the battle of hearts and minds on the world stage?
That seems true. There's been a lot of condemnation from civil society groups, criticism from human rights groups. That's probably true, yeah.
Now, strategy-wise, what good does it do for Hamas to keep firing rockets that seem to be mostly ineffective? Is there a long-term plan, or have they kind of backed themselves in a corner?
Hamas has backed themselves into a corner. The situation you have to remember, though, is that prior to this offensive, Gaza was a tough place to be in. There's been a blockade on Gaza for some time. There was 50% unemployment in Gaza. And really, the only thing Hamas can offer the population of Gaza that it represents is a continued war and resistance against Israel. So is there an end game for Hamas? Not really. They have to continue to put pressure on Israel in the hopes that Israel will declare a ceasefire.
Is this working for them in the sense that Palestinians have gained more support or more resolve in their belief in Hamas?
Probably not. But there's not a whole lot they can do. They can stop fighting, but the recent declarations by Netanyahu has been that this incursion is meant to diminish Hamas's military infrastructure, which is specifically its ability to launch rockets and the tunnels they have.
So if Israel actually ends up somehow eliminating Hamas, let's say entirely, the whole organization falls, what would be their long-term solution? Are they going to try to make it more stable through democratic terms, or what do you see is the future then if indeed Hamas does get eliminated by the Israeli military?
Well, we should be clear. Israel, I don't think most Israeli officials think they can eliminate Hamas. What they can do is significantly reduce Hamas's ability to launch rockets against Israel. So they are targeting the rocket launch sites, and they are targeting specifically the tunnels through which Hamas infiltrates Israel. And they're trying to collaborate with the Egyptians to block the supply of weapons, which gets into Gaza from the other side. Mm-hmm. So that's their goal. I don't think many Israelis think they can eliminate Hamas, whether it's the leadership or certainly the membership, which is quite large. But what they can do is really reduce Hamas's military infrastructure and ability to hit Israel. Now, once that is done, they can have three medium-term goals. The most likely is that they want to return to a status quo where they continue to blockade Gaza. And what they have achieved, though, is they've really limited Hamas's ability to rain rockets on Israel, which has proven to be extremely disruptive. Hamas has fired something like 2,700 rockets on Israel up to now. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that while there have not been a lot of Israeli casualties, there have been less than 5 civilian casualties. Each time this happens, the civilians have to run into shelters. Further, a week or so ago, they almost hit Ben-Gurion Airport, and flights from overseas stopped flying into the airport. So it's proven very disruptive to daily life in Israel. And the goal, at the very least, would be to reduce that disruption. The most likely option is that a status quo with a radically reduced Hamas ability to disrupt daily life in Israel. The less likely option, which has been offered by the Israeli foreign minister, Avidor Lieberman, is that after Hamas's military infrastructure is degraded, Israel lifts the blockade on Gaza, but seals off the border with Israel. And what that means essentially is that Gaza becomes the problem of Egypt. So they will lift the blockade, but they will seal the border and not allow any movement in for work or anything like that. And that is consistent with the effort to destroy the tunnels on the Israeli side. I'm not saying this is what will happen, but it's one possible option. It's a less likely option, but it has been brought up by the now Israeli foreign minister, Lieberman. The least likely option is a lasting solution, which is that after degrading Hamas's military infrastructure, this may make the Palestinian Authority more appealing to residents of Gaza. At which point, maybe Israel can offer a viable state. That, I think, is quite unlikely. Not for any other reason that there have been no intimations of it from the Israeli side. Pretty much everything I've read speaks to the idea that the Israelis are trying to really weaken Hamas to return to a status quo situation with fewer rocket attacks. And in fairness, they have... with the cooperation of Egypt, they have a great strategic opportunity to do so.
And to wrap things up and kind of bring it back to our context, our UBC context, would such a recent conflict as this one be something you actually bring to the classroom in the upcoming semester in your very own courses that you may be teaching?
I have not brought this conflict up in my classes in the past. Mm. I find that views are very polarized. It doesn't really provide a teachable opportunity. So I tend to avoid this because if I was going to teach it effectively, I would have to provide a lot of background information, which is not really worth the time in a class which is about more sort of concepts and theories than it is about a particular region or event.
Well, thank you for your time, Professor. It's been a privilege. And thanks again for reporting to us at CITR 101.9. This has been Rohit Joseph interviewing Dr. Arjun Chowdhury. Thank you.
Thank you, Rohit. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Next on News 101, we are pleased to present an episode of Wings entitled The Real L Words. The series is produced by Frida Worden, and this episode was produced and hosted by Caroline Gage.
Caroline Gage delivers one of her famous sermons for a lesbian tent revival. This one can be useful for everyone. It's titled The Real L Words.
There's a river of birds in migration. A nation of women with wings.
There's Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome, sisters. Welcome to the Lesbian Tent Revival Radio Hour. Now, today we're going to talk about the L words, the real L words. And one of them is not lesbian. No, sisters, we're going to talk about two L words today. Two L words, and one of them you may never have heard of at all, and the other one I bet you've heard way too much of. And there's a reason for this. There's a connection between why you have never heard of one and why you have heard too much of the other. A connection. And a connection in the brain is another word for what? That's right, sisters, for synapse. So listen up now. Synapse with me today. And you may save yourself a lot of money on those U-Haul rentals. Words. Words are important. Now I'm talking to you with what? With words. And you're doing what when I talk? You are synapsing because words make you think. When you hear a word, you think about it. Remember, when neurons fire together, they wire together. That's how we learn to read. Point to the picture, read the word, right? There's a little spark somewhere in the brain, a little neuron that fires when it hears its name. But what if there's no name for something? Then how's that little neuron going to spark? How are you going to think about something if you don't have a word for it? Yes, ma'am, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about mind control, words. And in the patriarchy, there are some things they want us to think about all the time, but not very clearly. And that's the first L word we're going to talk about. And then there's other things they don't want us to think about at all. So they try not to have a word for it, and that's going to be the second L word. Are you with me? And I want to give you two examples of how this works. The patriarchy loves words about romance and sex because those words get women to interact with the devil. So everybody knows the word date, everybody knows the word sexual, and those words are just fine and dandy because you still don't hear too much about lesbians. Okay, now before the 1970s, people weren't putting the word date together with rape. And they didn't put the word sexual together with harassment. You didn't hear those terms or read about them. Does this mean they weren't happening to women and hadn't been happening and happening a lot to women for about 200,000 years? No. Well, then why were there no terms for it? because our enemy did not want us to have a name for what they were doing to us, because if we couldn't name it, we couldn't frame it. And if we couldn't frame it, we couldn't get laws passed to protect ourselves. And that meant they could go on doing it to us as much as they wanted. So because dates are supposed to be voluntary, there couldn't be such a thing as date rape. She must have given mixed messages, or maybe she just changed her mind later. Probably she was jealous. And because sexual is supposed to refer to something pleasant and exciting, there couldn't possibly be sexual harassment. It was just a case of teasing a woman who had no sense of humor. Well, sisters, why did it take 200,000 years to name date rape and sexual harassment? Because it takes power to name things. And women have been slow, sisters, mighty slow to take that power. But in the 1960s, we had a movement. We had a movement. And we moved some shit. I mean, we were moving, and we were moving together, and we were moving stuff that was in our way, and that's a good thing. And we need another movement pretty damn bad. That's why we're at this lesbian tent revival, sisters, to get our asses moving again. But we did have a movement, and that movement had power, and we named ourselves, and we said we were sisters, and we were lesbians, and we named the patriarchy, and we found our clits, and we figured out that men were never going to find them, and we started doing it for ourselves. Yes, we did. Sisters doing it for ourselves. And sisters, date rape and sexual harassment are crimes today. They are crimes. You can put a date rapist in jail. Takes some work, but it can be done. You can get paid millions of dollars in damages from big corporations for sexual harassment. Why? Because we learned how to synapse in the 1960s. So, all right, let's talk about these L words. And that first one is the one you hear way too much of. Anybody here have an idea what that word is? Somebody say love, because if she did, she's right. First L word is love, so let's all say it. Love. Oh, let's say it again. Love. And we just love to say that word, don't we? We just love this song, and we just love this music, and we just love those burritos, and we just love this book, and we just love that movie, and we love you. Oh, my goddess, do we love you. We love the way you smile. We love the way you smell. We love, love, love the way you touch us. And we love, and we love, and we love, and we love, and we love. And sisters, I'm getting worn out from how much we just love to say we love shit. I'm getting worn out because love is a tired word. It is overworked. It's a word expected to do too many things. It's a word that's supposed to be in too many places at once. Now, what happens to people when we have too many things to do and too many places to be? We end up not doing anything very well and hardly ever being where we should be. And that's exactly what is happening to our love today. Now, I'm going to tell you about Sister Suzette Hayden Elgin. Sister Suzette Hayden Elgin, E-L-G-I-N. She's a mighty sister of the sacred synapse. Sister Suzette understood words. She understood the power of words. She wrote a book called The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense, which is a powerful weapon for women. All about how our enemy uses language against us. The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense. And she wrote another book, a science fiction book, called Native Tongue. And in Native Tongue, Sister Suzette writes about a community of women in the future who have invented their own language called Leaden. Leaden. And Leaden is a language all about synapsing correctly. So today, sisters, we're going to have ourselves a little lesson in Leaden. Yes, we are right here. I'm going to read you a list of words in Leaden and what they mean. And I want you to be thinking about someone in your life that you would say you love. Could be anybody, a child, an ex-lover, someone you just met, your partner. That's right. You got somebody in mind? Good, because here we go. These are 11 words in Leaden, and they all mean love in our language. Okay. Aya, mysterious love, not yet known to be welcome or unwelcome. Aage, love for one sexually desired at one time, but not now. Ab, love for one liked, but not respected. Ad, love for one respected, but not liked. Am, love for one related by blood. Ashan, love for one not related by blood, but kin of the heart. Aya, love that is unwelcome and a burden. Aj, love for one sexually desired now. Iimi, love for one neither liked nor respected. Oham, love for that which is holy. Sham, love for the child of one's body, presupposing neither liking nor respect nor their absence. And I'm going to add two more. These are Sister Carolyn's, not Sister Suzette's. Oh no. Now that's love for someone you slept with before you took the time to know them or let them know you. And uh-oh, that's love for someone who's already in a relationship. Now you really had to synapse listening to that, didn't you? You had to go deep. Couldn't just skate by with, I love you. You had to be synapsing with the heart, with the clit, with your history, with your head. That's right. If you're talking about love and Laodin, you have to be fully present. And because you had to use language that made you think deeply, you probably had to draw a conclusion. Like, this is a good idea or this is a really bad idea. And once you've drawn a conclusion, you may just have to take action. Now, I wonder why the English language is so vague about the word that's going to describe our most intense emotional relationships. We have more vocabulary, my sisters, for real estate transactions than we do for intimate ones. Now, why is that? Because the patriarchy wants people to know exactly what they're getting when they enter into a real estate transaction. Uh-huh. It does not want people, especially women, to know what we're getting into when we fall in love. Well, why not? Because historically, heteropatriarchal relationships have handed women the short end of the stick, so to speak. We all know the statistics about how married men live longer than single men, but single women live longer than married ones. We know that historically, marriage has been a property boondoggle, which gets back to why there's such specific words for real estate and not specific words for love. When a word is vague, sisters, our thinking is vague. And when our thinking is vague, we don't make clear decisions. And we especially don't make clear decisions to protect ourselves and our enemy. And who's our enemy? That's right. He does not want us to know how to protect ourselves.
That was an excerpt from an episode of Wings entitled The Real L Words. This series is produced by Frida Worden, and this episode was produced and hosted by Carolyn Gage. Our thanks to them for sharing that on NCRA. That's our program for today, August 1st. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Marco.
And I'm Chirag. Today's show was produced by Seher. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded with Matt right here on CITR 101.9 FM.